On this episode of the Culture Shock Podcast, we talk about all things Black Lives Matter, empowering black communities, and the state of the culture. So without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome to the Culture Shock Podcast. My name is Dime Adeboye and I have my special guest today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi everyone, my name is Bayo Adelaja and I am the founder of a social enterprise called Do It Now Now.
Awesome. So what is Do It Now Now?
Essentially, we call ourselves an open innovation organization, which basically means that we are a broker of information and contacts across a number of different sectors so that we can essentially work with a bunch of different people so that we can support black people, basically. That's probably the worst description I've ever given of what we do. But the tagline is empowering black people everywhere. And we just happen to work with a whole bunch of different companies, organizations, government departments, and so on to make that happen.
Awesome. How did you get started? What year did you get started, essentially?
2016. That's when I started running the company. And I went full time in 2017, I want to say.
Yeah,
2017.
Well, that's pretty cool. And what made you get started in the first place for you?
I had already built a tech startup while I was at university. I didn't know it was a tech startup at the time. I just thought I was doing something a little bit fun. And I just happened to use technology and I like learning new things. So I was just doing something. And later on, like years later, people were like, oh, that was a tech startup. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And apparently it was quite successful. I didn't know that either because I had no one to compare it to. Anyway, I ended up in research. So I was a social policy researcher at the London School of Economics. And I was basically working very closely with large charities and the government to understand what basically they could do to provide services for underserved populations, but rather cheaply. Mm. And unfortunately, as I kept working in that space, one, I realized that these kinds of conversations weren't happening across Africa, because for all intents and purposes, what we were seeing across Africa were governments were making decisions kind of based on a whim or based on very lacking data. So that was interesting to me as a problem that I was passionate about. I still am passionate about. But then in the UK, the problem that I was seeing was that the people that were making decisions as to the future of the country were not being informed by the populace in the same way that they were intending to be. So they would say, go and talk to some grassroots organizations and understand their challenges, and then couple that with some like large scale data that you get from like the Office of National Statistics or whatever, and bring us a picture. This is a very rudimentary way of describing the work, but basically bring us a picture of what the normal people are saying and then what the data is saying, and together you should be able to tell us what we should do. And more often than not, there was not a single black person on the table when it came to what normal people are experiencing. And that was problematic. That's highly problematic. Yeah. This was a few years ago before diversity was a buzzword and a topic people really held on to. But it was something that I kind of started thinking about in terms of Afrofuturism, which is only really a term I started using about 2 years ago, because it's very difficult to see black people in the future and plan for black people in the future if you don't include black people today. So that's kind of the scope that I started Do It Now Now with, as to how can I tackle some of this. And it eventually kind of ended up in the tech entrepreneurship leadership and activism space. So that's what we do now. We support black people to build social enterprises, to become leaders in their local community, and to become activists that can run campaigns based on subjects that they care about.
That's very empowering. And I guess coming from my, obviously me being black as well, I think when we think about education roots, and obviously Nigerian parents for me, go to school, study hard, get a good career, you know, which is all good. The foundation is set up for a lot of people. You don't have to really think that hard to get to that point, but, you know, there's an emphasis in that in our culture. But then when you get into the working environment, it ends up being, okay, I'm just here to serve, but am I here to lead? And then you look around and you look at the blueprint and say, okay, can I look around and follow an example that's similar to what I want to achieve in terms of that vision. And then it ends up being that sort of, well, I don't see much available. And then when you do start seeing the table, there's not many chairs available. So that one spot, apparently, which then becomes problematic because you feel like you're competing to get into that same position. Yeah. And then for me, I don't know, I think the whole diversity sort of buzzword has been incorporated in companies because they want to do more, but how they get there is a different question. What would you say to corporations in general in terms of that seat at the table?
I think it's been said quite well by a lot of people, thankfully, over the past couple of years. I don't think any of this will be rather new, but it's really around the scope of like inviting someone to the party isn't the same thing as inviting that person to dance. Yeah. Or I used to add, it's not the same as inviting that person to add to the playlist. Mm. Like it's very different. People know when they're a token, and no one wants to be a token. And it's honestly, the detokenization or the kind of fight against tokenism sometimes does go too far. I once sat at a round table, and there was a lot of conversation going around. That story is milder than this other story I've just thought of. So I'll tell the second story. I was at an event, and it was a full day conference, and it was about diversity and technology in like the technology ecosystem. And I think it must have been about 10 different panels throughout the day. So it was a very long day. Mm. And I think really just out of politeness, I stuck it out throughout the day and was just really waiting for that last panel, because that last panel was the one that they were going to talk about racial diversity in, because the 9 panels before that had been about gender.
Yeah.
So I was like, cool, black and woman, let's see how this goes. Yeah. So I'm sitting there, and it was boring for a lot of it, but it was also interesting. There were some good points being thrown about here and there. And at the in that final panel where it was about race, it was the first time that the entire conversation centered around tokenism.
Yeah.
Where it was like, well, we want racial diversity, but like, you can't just hire tokens. And this is black people on the stage talking about tokenism. I'm like, why are you talking about tokenism like that is the default? Like, if a black person gets to that seat at the table, it was tokenism. Yeah. And honestly, the only way the reason people feel so strongly against tokenism and they are so wary of being the token is because once you get them there, you don't actually think about making sure that they are fully included.
Yeah.
And that's what makes people feel like a token. Mm. I remember reading this paper on depression in the workplace, and it said that autonomy was the key factor in determining your experience of depression and your experience of wellness within your workplace. Like your ability to organize your time, organize your interactions, feel like you had some kind of place there that you could say, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, and this is what I want to do. And it didn't necessarily mean that you were a manager or you were a leader. It meant that people respected you. Mm. And respected your input enough to listen to it. Yeah. And it doesn't always feel like that. I remember my job at LSE was the most fun and the most hellish time at the same time. because I really loved my department. My department was incredible, but the university itself was bureaucratic, and it had all of the drawbacks that a person like me who didn't have a PhD, when everyone else had a PhD or was working on a PhD, and then is black and is a woman. So I'm like, I mean, is it misogyny? Is it racism? Or is it me not having a PhD? Like, which one of these is it? because not everyone had a PhD. There were people who didn't have PhDs that kept getting promoted. And I was just like, hi, my department has approved my promotion 2 different times, or was it 3 different times?
Yeah.
And the university keeps saying no. So you don't know me, my department knows me, they think I'm ready, why won't you let me have it? It was really weird. But my department's boss, who'd been there for about 40 years, he noticed that I wasn't speaking in meetings. And he just kind of pulled me aside and asked me about it, because I mean, I wouldn't speak, but then I'd send emails afterwards, just like of all my thoughts. And I'm speaking. And it was honestly that conversation that made me feel really, really comfortable. He kind of took the time to reassure me. And this was not my first job, but it was my first like post-university job. And he took the time to reassure me that I was there for a reason, and that I didn't need to kind of, that my input and everything that I had to say, my experiences were valid in the space, mm-hmm. and that I should come forward and speak my mind, because if I wasn't speaking my mind, then I was wasting the space. Mm-hmm. And that, he didn't quite put it like that. He put it a lot nicer than that. Mm-hmm. But it was enough to kind of make me kind of become comfortable. And like in rooms where he wasn't there, there were moments where people just kind of dismissed me again. But I had to learn to fight for that space that I was taking up. And I mean, I recognize, and I don't want this to be the entire thing because I know you have other questions. I recognize that, like, not for nothing, I have 2 master's degrees. Mm. I have this accent. I went to the universities that I went to. Mm. I know that there are more things about me that will make people pay attention than dismiss me. Mm. Yet, I am so often in spaces where I'm like, do I have to say this? Do I have to remind you? Do I have to prove myself over and over again for you to remember? And it's honestly, it's detrimental to your mental health at the end of the day. But I think I focus a lot on power and privilege when it comes to the workplace. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot about how I can own my power in a space, whether that's as simple as saying, if this is not serving me, I will not succumb to it. I will not beg for a place here. Mm-hmm. If you are determined to treat me like crap in it. So mm-hmm. even the ability to walk away mm-hmm. has, and the I gift myself the option of walking away. And although walking away from opportunities is hard, it has been the saving grace of my mental health in those spaces, because I know that I can leave if I want to.
Yeah. Listen, I'm not going to be around the bush and stuff. I've gone through the same situation. I was working for a large consultancy firm straight out of uni, and I was lucky to be there, quote unquote. And because of being in that situation and knowing people who had let me trace it back. I think if I want to really dive into the problem area, it's probably because of the communication skills to get to the places that I want to get to. So for example, me and you are talking, we probably come from similar backgrounds, so the way we're talking, we understand each other. But sometimes when you're speaking to someone who doesn't look like you or represent where you're coming from, you're having to sort of, that's that person here and you're over there and you're trying to reach over to sort of get their attention. So sometimes yeah. you come out overshowing or having a chip on your shoulder or having an element of notice me. Like, and even though when you're not doing that, you're being too quiet. You don't want to be too seen because you don't want to be judged for that area yeah. as well. So yeah. I can see it being such a, so I'd say toxic, but it's one of those things where we don't have, it's not we, but the system in place doesn't allow us to feel comfortable voicing our opinions, like you said, or voicing our ideas. So to have a mentor who can fully back you where you're going in your career or just in life is so important. And I think for me, the way I found success was actually, like you said, taking my power back and saying, you know what, the market doesn't judge fully, but in an organization, you're judging me. So if the market says I've got good skills, I must go out and assess that and see if I'm up to the speed of, you know, keeping up with the market versus you saying yes or no. And that's why I lead by. So if I'm doing well, the market says yes. If I'm not doing well, I adjust. And that's been my way of finding success. So I've gone through that learning curve, but I wish I had someone to source, sit me down and say, look, this is where you need to go, this way to navigate. But I think life's been a great teacher to me, and I think life's been a great teacher to you. But I know so many people who get frustrated and give up and then end up doing something completely different or taking sort of decisions very short term versus long term. So does Do It Now Now help sort of navigate those areas as well?
Not yet. Because it's such a minefield. It's such an incredible minefield. That's one of the spaces that we've tried to get into. But our model requires corporations to pay us so that we can do the work. And it's kind of going in there and saying, be nice to your employees, particularly the Black ones, because this is the background that we're coming from. And I mean, it's one thing to go in and give a speech, which I mean, we could do and we have done. But that isn't, I mean, our focus is about creating lasting change. So if there isn't going to be some kind of program that we can set up, some kind of peer group that we can set up, something that we can ensure is moving the dialogue forward, then it's not really, it's kind of a waste of our time. Like, money is money, but time is so much worth so much more than money. And so we haven't been able to find the right way to do it yet. Like, there've been so many designs of like things that we could do, and it's just not come to the right solution, but we're actually working on something right now. So, and that will give us the opportunity to be fully independent of the corporations as well, in terms of financing. So we're working on it, but it is something I am passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, especially when you go through that experience, you have, no matter how successful you are, you always kind of want to give back or even sort of see how you can improve that area. So
absolutely 100%. I always just like think of the like the Black girl working in like, I don't know, PwC or something, and like I just keep thinking, are you actually okay? Making money, doing a job, all of that stuff is one thing, but are you okay? Do you feel good about your chances of being promoted? Do you feel good about the friendships that you're forming? If you're going to spend 70% of your life at work, is that part of your life okay? And I mean, I just kind of, I was walking once and I saw this girl in a PwC building, and she was just kind of walking to lunch on her own. And like this Black girl, she was just walking to lunch on her own. And I just thought, I hope she has friends in there. Because it, like, it's such a, like, big corporates are such a lonely place to work. And if you have no one beside you, even if you don't have your like other Black people or other people of color beside you, it's so hard. And like, honestly, it's, I don't think I would say to anyone, if you want to have like a career, go into a big corporate. I wouldn't suggest it, but if you are like, that's what I want to do and you want that experience, then go ahead. But I don't know, I just feel so sorry for everybody that works there.
Well, you're talking to someone who's worked there for almost 7 years, 6 years, 7 years. Yeah, and for me, obviously I went contracting afterwards, but I was lucky to find friends in some of my projects where we're still friends now, who just understood, like, they understood my Blackness, they understood my professionalism, they understood my humor, everything. But when I was with teens that, you know, didn't represent any element of who I was, it was always that, oh, just be nice and smile and just make sure you get your work done and don't ruffle any feathers and stuff like that. And it just ended up being like, I did feel isolated, not gonna lie, but I knew that's fine, because my goal wasn't to make friends, my goal was to do the best of my career and so forth. But then I did question my why. Like, why am I actually here? Because essentially, like I just mentioned earlier, you go to school, you get a good job. Where's the best job? Work for one of the big four, work for one of the big consultancy firms. But then after that, what, become manager? And then from there, what, become senior manager? I mean, that level of progression is great, and I'm not knocking that down. But when you're told that all your life, and then you get there and you realize, that's not the way it was supposed to be. It's like this Disney fairy tale of what life should be. And then you go in and you're like, oh, so this is what it is. And then when you're trying to get yourself through it, you have to work 10 times harder. And not knocking anyone who's in those situations in consultancy firms or big fours and so forth. They do work hard. I know people who put 12 hours, 10 hours in.
Oh, absolutely.
That wasn't me.
I think when I say, like, I wouldn't suggest it on any to anyone to go into one of those types of companies, like, is because for me, why is such a massive part of everything that I do. Like, I I joke, half joke, that I can deal with my own homelessness and destitution as long as I know that I'm doing something that I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very real about that. And that is a very real part of my personality, that I know that if I'm passionate about something, I have to follow it through.
Yeah.
And I think most people, well, not all people, actually, I think there are a lot of people that can work for the weekend and do those really long hours. But for people like me, who I wear my heart on my sleeve, I'm very open with people. I don't, like, as long as it's not inappropriate, if you ask me a question, I'm going to give you a fully straight answer.
Yeah.
I used to say, ask me anything and I'll tell you. And then people started asking me appropriate questions. So now I have to caveat. But no, I'm very, very straightforward and open with people. So to be in spaces where I then have to kind of duck my head and navigate, just to kind of survive in a space, kind of makes me feel stifled.
Mm.
And it makes me feel smaller and smaller, and it kind of makes me feel like a shut-in. And I can't deal with spaces that I need to be smaller than who I am.
Yeah.
Which is why I started saying, I started this with saying that my gift to myself is walking away. Because I need to know that I can do that. If things get hard, and not hard in terms of like a long work day, because I mean, I run this business and I do ridiculously long hours. Like at the moment, for the past 3 months, I have been waking up, picking up my laptop, starting working, set up my like workstation, continue working, ready to start feeling sleepy, get into bed with my laptop, still working. I am a workaholic. I'm not suggesting that everyone does that, but I work fully all the time, all out, always I am working. And that's because I can do that because I'm so passionate about the stuff that I do.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine being in a space where I don't have full passion for my work and the outcome of my work.
Mm.
And I think if you can discover your true passion, it becomes a lot easier to live. Like I say, you spend 70% of your time working, of your life working. So if you're going to spend that much time working, you should live and die for what you do. Like that should be everything to you.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, considering I'm not married or have children, like it can be everything to me right now. But I think there is, for Black people, and going back to what you said, when we first started Do It Now, I used to have so many conversations with people that would tell me that they were a doctor for now, lawyer for now, accountant for now. And that's because they grew up the same way that I grew up, which was lawyer, doctor, engineer, that architect was even the most creative thing you would find on that list, architect.
Yeah.
There was just no acceptance of anything that wasn't a very, very stable career path that was stable in our parents' day, without any regard for how the world had changed.
Yeah.
And it meant that we were brought up to believe a very specific set of rules that just don't play well in the real world. And I was supposed to be a lawyer. So when I was 8, I decided between lawyer and doctor. when I was 8. It was in a game of hopscotch. I decided I was either going to name my square Byers Doctor Office or Byers Lawyer Office. And I named it Byers Lawyer Office and never looked back. Mm. Had no real idea what a lawyer did, but I just knew that it was one of those jobs that was okay.
Yeah.
And it took me a really long time to I started getting internships. And I was like, I don't like this.
Mm.
I don't like the idea of just making rich people richer. That ain't me.
Yeah.
And just, it took me a while to kind of get over that. But then I remember that I wrote a 17, nowadays, like I write much longer documents, but it took me, but at the time it was ridiculously long. It was a 17 page presentation that I wrote for my mum to convince her to let me study English instead of law. And she finally said yes, but only because one of the key points was that I could eventually convert to law after the English degree, which I didn't. I didn't convert to law. But I think there is and it's the same thing for immigrant parents around the world. I think when you emigrate from one poorer country typically to a country with more perceived wealth and perceived opportunities available to you, you're in a position where you feel like you just want your kids to have the most stable opportunity. And so you kind of bring them up with a very specific set of rules. And any kind of abandonment of those rules is a betrayal. And I'm glad that I never had to say lawyer for now, because I just didn't do it. And it took a really long time up until like till today, I am still convincing my mom that I made the right decision. she's fine with the fact that I studied like social policy and all of that stuff and governments and blah-de-da. So every once in a while, she still sends me jobs from the, like, World Bank, and she sends me PhD applications to fill in, because she's just like, this a business, it could go belly up any day, and COVID has taught us that. And that's very difficult for her to deal with, because her hope for me is stability.
Yeah, I completely understand that. And when you think about our parents and just the sacrifices they made to just even come here and start from scratch and, you know, build their own sort of homes and raise children, and then it seemed the best for them because that's the sacrifice they took. So they're assuming that's the sort of, you know, prosperity that they want for the children. And then I'm not saying parents don't do a good job. They do a great job raising us to be model citizens and good human beings and stuff. But then when it comes to dreams, it's like, what's dreams? The dreams are stability, right? Dreams are, yeah, for children, right? So you kind of just like, okay, I'll suck it up, and you just move through life. But when you think about life, it's a big scope of how many years you got to live. And like you say, your why is pretty much your purpose. You want to live with purpose. And I think sometimes we miss that mark, you know, trying to sort of identify what that is and searching for it. And it's not something that you think about when you're, like you said, 6, 8 years old or whatever the age you are. You have to go through life experience to kind of find that, or it finds you. And when you find it, it's the best thing in the world, right? You live by it. It doesn't matter how many hours you work. It's not work to you. It's something you have to do, because if you don't do it, it eats in you. Like this podcast for me, it's not something that I'm doing for monetary reasons. I do it because I think these conversations need to be had. You know, this is just me taking a risk on myself. No matter how big or small the opportunities may get, I still want to do them, because I know there's people like you who are out there living by purpose. And I think when we look at the Black community as a whole, there's a lot of conversations about, you know, seats at the tables, or people want to be, not only seats and tables, let me take that back. I think when it comes to success with Black people, it's always been sports or entertainment. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously people who work in the business world and, you know, professional worlds of like lawyers, doctors, and accountants, and, you know, engineers and so forth. But is there anyone who's pushing the needle to do more than that? Is there a group of people out there? And when they are out there and celebrated, they're sports stars and celebrities. So I'm just thinking to myself, that shouldn't be it. That shouldn't be the conversation. I think we are a whole spectrum of different people doing different things. No matter if you are in those professional worlds or you're someone who's taking the risk to live by purpose, I think we should all be celebrated. So I think we're new into this. I think this generation of, you know, Black people are experiencing something new in terms of how we portray ourselves. And I think it's very exciting at the same time. But
absolutely agreed.
Yeah. But I was thinking about activism, and obviously with Black Lives Matter being such a focal point nowadays, what is the best sort of move that a lot of people can do going forwards for themselves and for others to sort of recognize the efforts of Black people?
Oh, wow. Okay. Recognize the efforts?
Yeah, of efforts. Black people? Yeah, in general, in history, and just in present day.
Okay. I mean, there's so much, though. Like, I know when Black Lives Matter, the protests started really taking off, it was like a slow burn, because there was Ahmaud Arbery, before that, but reported much later, I believe, if my timeline is correct, Breonna Taylor was killed. And then we found out later. And then there was Amy Cooper and her dog, who ran up on the Harvard professor or graduate or someone like
that.
He was a smart dude. The birder that kept calling him a birder. Then we had George Floyd. And it was this kind of, like, the first one happened, but we'd seen that before. Ahmaud Arbery, we'd seen something like that before. It was heartbreaking. It was disgusting. It was awful, but we'd seen it. Then you move on to Amy Cooper. And I mean, for me, it felt like, well, that's just another woman who is weaponizing her whiteness against a black man for no reason whatsoever. And is apparently strangling her dog, if you watch the video.
Yeah, were you talking to that dog?
Yeah, it was awful. But it was just like, I'm going to say there's a black man's threatening my life. Dude, he told you to leash your dog. Like, wow. It was a lot. But we'd seen that before. Like, we'd seen so many of those stories already that it had actually at that time become a bit of a joke to kind of the Karens. It was reduced to that kind of diatribe of, oh, just another white woman. So that one was like, okay, well, we've seen that before. And then Breonna Taylor came out. That story became publicized. And it was like, oh, okay. But we've seen that before. That was terrible, but we've seen it before. And then George Floyd happened, and I still haven't watched that video. I refuse to. I can't watch it. But it was like I've heard enough people talk about it to know what happens in it. And it was just like the quick succession of all of these different stories. Like, all four of them, if you look at them, are all very different.
Yeah, different
in stuff. How they happened, but they are the big story. Like, if you were going to plot the, like, violence against black people in America story across, like, an axis of, like, a four-part axis of, like, the type that is like this, the type is that is like A, the type is like type B, type C, type D, we got type A, type B, type C, and type D in such quick succession that it was like, apparently everyone just kind of got it. And all the things that we've been talking about for like 10 years or so, I suppose, were just suddenly, it clicked for people that Obama did not solve racism. That voting in a black president did not solve racism in America. It actually just angered a lot of white people who were already racist.
Yeah.
And decided that they could not be ruled by a black person. How dare he even breathe? And now we're having this conversation about allyship, and we're having this conversation about the future of black people and what black people bring to the table, and why we shouldn't have to justify our space. We shouldn't have to explain why we need to be there, and we should be appreciated. We should be celebrated. And there's so much left still to unpack about what's going on and what the reaction is going to be. But I think the only thing that a white person can do in this situation is educate themselves. And I know that seems like a throwaway, like I'm trying to avoid the conversation by saying, you, go educate yourself. And once they do educate themselves, we can then talk about it. I mean, black people, if you don't have a way to organize that conversation effectively, nothing's going to change in that relationship. So we need to take responsibility. It sucks, but we do need to take responsibility for teaching as well, which is annoying. And you shouldn't be doing it if you're annoyed by it. Like, leave it to someone who isn't annoyed by it in that moment, because everyone goes through ebbs and flows, don't they, of like one being okay with doing that work, and for me, I for a month there I was like, please don't talk to me, don't invite me on any panels, I don't want to be here, I don't want to have to talk about this, leave me alone. And now I'm okay with it. So everyone goes through ebbs and flows, but for black people, there is nothing that we can do besides live. I mean, our efforts aren't going to be appreciated just because, like, because of a campaign, like, what, there was 56 black men, right, that went viral in the UK,
yeah,
and in parts of Europe as well, I believe. And the premise of that campaign was that for every one black man that commits a crime, there are 56 black men that didn't, that are doing something great, or just like average people. And I kind of started, that campaign was, it was interesting, and it was interesting from the perspective that it got very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of looking at it, but I wasn't sure what about it. And a few people that I know and I respect and I cheer on were involved, like they were some of the men. But there was something about it that just felt a bit off. And it was only, I couldn't place my finger on it. So I started reading up about it, like what other people were saying about it, because I didn't know where it was, what was like disturbing me, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was basically respectability politics, that we have to be exceptional to be noticed as good.
That's the thing.
And that's not right.
Yeah.
The mere fact that a black person is waking up in this world is commendable. It is. Mm. I mean, think about it. You go into work and you know that in the UK at least, globally, black people live in the most deprived areas.
Yeah.
Globally, black people are the most at risk of ill health, of preventable diseases like diabetes, obesity, those kinds of things. Mm. In developed countries, because, and obesity isn't actually brought on by laziness, just in case you didn't know, listener, obesity is brought on by eating very cheap food that has a high sugar, high salt, and high fat content, because that's what cheap food is.
Yeah.
It's black people, there isn't data on this racially, but just based on the convergence of poverty and recipient of benefits and just significant hardship, black women and people born female are more likely to be impacted by period poverty.
Mm.
Black women racially are the most likely to be committed into mental institutions in the UK. There's a lot that we're dealing with. We have the least amount of savings.
Mm.
We have the least amount of property. There's a lot that goes into just breathing,
yeah,
as a black person.
Thank you.
And I don't think we should force ourselves to be exceptional.
Mm.
I think that's unfair. And I think it's harmful. And it's heartbreaking, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I think efforts, recognizing our efforts, should be as much as recognizing our existence.
I agree. I think, you know, you unpacked it a lot, and I'm going to probably talk about something else mm-hmm. related to what you just mentioned. But there's an element that I agree, and there's an element that unfortunately, I'm like, okay, even though that's the circumstance, I'm happy it happened. I don't think everyone should go out and be superhuman. I don't think that's everyone's destiny. Everyone's destiny is just to do the best they can in this world and live a world of, you know, what pleases them, but also pleases others, if that's possible. Even though through hard times, if you can take the good with the bad and make it what it is for yourself and, you know, for your joy, then do it. For me, I guess, because I've been lucky to sort of move around as much as possible and in a way move into areas that are white areas, and then being a token for a lot of my life, kind of having to sort of, you know, work through that system, kind of understanding the code switching for one, and then also those expectations of, I hope you don't dress like this because otherwise it looks like you're this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And then that obviously changed my mindset of like how I dress, how I talk, how I walk, where I work, for example, because I don't want people thinking you came from this area, but you didn't make something out of yourself, you know. And then luckily I bought my own place, and then I'm like, haha. But that was for me, but it was also like, almost like F you to everyone else. But then, but then at the same time, I'm like, why? Who am I proving this to? Like, where's this all coming from? And when the whole sort of first of all, Black Lives Matter, that was such an important movement, and that still is an important movement. But what also came to light was all these microaggressions that came as well of expectations, but also, you know, comments and here and there. And I realized that I went through so much and I didn't realize what it was. But I was like, I was pushing it down, suppressing it, and just saying, I'll step above it. That's fine. I've got tough skin. I'll just move on. And whilst I did build strong character, it really did sort of make me reflect in my whole sort of history and go, that wasn't normal. Because you wouldn't ask the same person who is a different race to me, he's white probably, who's a white male, for example, did that person have the same experience? And they probably wouldn't have one tenth of that experience, you know, or if they're lucky. So it's just like, okay, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And for me, it's like, okay, the character building, I can look back and say, you know, I'm strong because of it. But was that required? Luckily for me, I was able to handle that responsibility. But a lot of people are not. And that's where it crumbles a lot of our spirits. And then, like you said, the whole economic standpoint and socioeconomics of everything. Yeah, it's very disheartening. There's no real reason for that to happen in the first place. But it just makes you realize because of where a lot of Black people moved to in terms of, you know, different areas and then saying, okay, we'll just leave them be or over police or just not neglect. That's the word I think we're going to use. It just creates a problem for a lot of people. And then it's just continuous all along. So that's very frustrating. But then another aspect I always thought about, but didn't really think about too much, is obviously you're a Black female. So you've got two areas to sort of, you know, look at. You're black and you're female. And so the elements of moving around, navigating through life, that's a separate challenge in its own right. So from your experience, how has that been for you?
I mean, honestly, it depends on the day that you catch me. Because I have been known to say that I don't like thinking too much about the fact that I'm Black and a woman and whatever. I said it earlier because I didn't know at that time if I was being discriminated against within in my workplace because I was Black, because I was a woman, or because I didn't have a PhD. I just couldn't put my finger on it because no one was going to tell me, oh, it's because you're Black, that's why we're not doing this. Oh, it's because you don't, like, no one's gonna clarify to your face, or if they do, then that's a hate crime and you should definitely take them to prison. But for the most part, it was just so impossible to tell. So I just decided to stop thinking about it and just decided to say, if someone didn't like me, then they didn't like me, and then I move on. Because my thought process is there are 7 billion people on the planet, nearly 8 billion people now. And if one person doesn't like me, I will find another person, and that person would be as much of a dick. And that was what I thought. Yeah. And that helped me keep my sanity. Like, again, keeping your autonomy, keeping your power as a Black person is so important, because the world is designed to crap on your face. Like, that is the entire world is designed to crap on the face of Black people. And you keeping your sanity is going to be the biggest thing that is going to keep you moving forward. And the way I chose to keep my sanity was to ensure that I was seeing my decision making and saying, okay, I can walk away, I can change this, I can do this, I can move. But that's a lot of disruption I'm bringing onto my own life anyway. But and so that's problematic in itself. But on the flip side, if in this conversation, I suppose, I mean, I recognize that there is a level of misogyny that I experience from Black men that is surprising to me. Mm-hmm. Like, the more successful I have become, the more I notice it. And I mean, it's Black men, so it's not because I'm Black.
And we could talk about it for sure.
So it's like, so it's weird to notice, it's weird to see, it's weird to experience. But I get it. And I don't mean I excuse it, I mean I understand it. Because, and this is why that Malcolm X quote is so important, because the most disrespected, the most neglected, the most unsupported, whatever the actual quote is that played in Beyonce's Homecoming documentary and a bunch of other places, but that's the that's a specific place I'm remembering right now. Once you recognize that Black people across the globe are generally the lowest ranked race, when you recognize that and just recognize it from the perspective of like the aggregate experience of life expectancy, life satisfaction, money we have in our pockets across, like when you look across the globe, like the perspective of Black people, if you were going to rank it, if there was a social experiment that allowed people to do that, because that I don't think would get approved by anybody, but if there was a social experiment where people honestly ranked race, I think based on what we can notice but don't say out loud, I think most people would agree that generally Black people are at the bottom in terms of perception. I know Arabs have a lot of stuff that they're dealing with, and specifically Arab Muslim people have even more stuff that they're dealing with. But none of it is the same. But let's just assume that that's true. And it isn't from my understanding of the subject, also considering the fact that my entire life's work is based on the study of Black people. So I will always say Black people have it worse. We need to fight for Black people because that's what I do every day. Yeah. But from the perspective of misogyny, when you're looking at a Black man, he is at the apex of the Black kingdom, right? The Black experience. So a Black man that is having hardship in his own life, in weakness, could take it out on the people that are lower ranked than him in the social sphere. So that would be Black women, Black LGBTQ, Black trans, Black non-binary, those people. Mm-hmm. And that, so I had gone through a lot of my life not experiencing Black misogyny. So I just thought it didn't exist. I don't know why I thought it didn't exist, but I just thought it didn't exist. I was just like, all the Black men I've met have been really like champions and great and like really supportive and all of that stuff. But then I started re-examining the experiences that I've had and realized that that wasn't actually true. And I had just given, the same way that I'd given a lot of people excuses over the years because I didn't want to deal with the fact that someone was being racist towards me, because again, like for me, that would have meant that I would have to recognize that they had power over my situation and I could do nothing to change it. Because if someone is being racist, they are using your race against you in a power dynamic. That is what racism is. It isn't just I don't like you because you are Black. It is I have power in a situation and I'm using that power against you so that you cannot socially progress. And in every situation, I had just decided, nope, I just need to work harder. Nope, I just need to be nicer. Nope, I just need to do this. I just need to do that. And that was what helped me get through it, because it meant I just needed to work hard. And it was only in moments where I just thought, I'm not progressing here and I have exhausted everything that I could possibly have done. And therefore this is likely either Black, either race, either the fact that I'm a woman or something else that I just can't achieve right now. Yeah. And I think that third element really helped me get through a lot. Like there was something I just couldn't achieve. And so I can't be here anymore. I'm apparently just not right for this space. Recently, I've been looking back and I've been reckoning, I suppose, with a lot of the things that I told myself to help myself get through situations. And it's Black misogyny, man. Interesting.
You know, talking about just dynamics and people and how we're supposed to work together or just understand each other, it's very interesting because you did mention, like, okay, maybe in the spectrum of things of, like, hierarchy, like, you got Black men in general taking this sort of upper tier and then it goes down and down and down. I never thought about it, but not from a family dynamic, but from a street perspective, right? Like, you know, music and so forth, like misogyny is there, like the disrespect to the LGBTQ community, it was there. It's, anyway, hopefully it's less prominent now, but it used to be in all the song lyrics back in the day. And that sort of brainwashing of hate was always in the subculture of our culture in that sense. And I think now we're being more open to a lot of conversations and, you know, understanding people a bit more. It's reduced, but the history is still there as well. And so it makes it hard for a lot of people to recognize the faults that exist in our own selves before we look at other people as well. Do you feel we need to look at each other first before we ask people to understand us as a group of people? Or do you think it needs to be dynamic? How do you think that conversation should take place, really?
I think it will be dynamic because nothing is going to organize itself as neatly as that.
Yeah.
I mean, there will always be, I remember there was when Oluwatoyin died, Lawal, I feel like I got her name wrong and I'm so sorry about that. But the Black Lives Matter activist that was killed, was raped and killed by a black man, which was very uncomfortable in this context to recognize that it was a black man that did that.
Mm.
When that happened, there was a lot of conversation around like black men taking ownership of their role in the black community as protectors of the rest of the black community and kind of being the brothers and fathers and helpers to the rest of us because of the fact that they are men.
Yeah.
There were men that were saying, yes, we should do that. We should take care. Like, and it was from the family perspective that we are fathers, we are big brothers, we are, and if you're not a big brother, you're a proverbial big brother to somebody else in your community. You should be looking to ensure that everyone is taken care of and everyone is supported. And funny enough, that's not advocating for gang culture, but that was a big, in the movies, that's always a big part of gang culture, that they're doing it so that they can take care of the neighborhood. I don't want to go around quoting Jay-Z lyrics, but there's a bunch of stuff in Jay-Z lyrics. particularly the story of OJ talks about buying take your drug money and buy the neighborhood. Like,
exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Like, organize it, get food to the people, all of that stuff. Like, it's very much about, it's organized around, you do this stuff, this not so great stuff, so that you can take care of people.
Yeah.
And so there were people that has also been laced through the music. It's not just like the, I mean, drag bitches kind of thing. It's like all of the other stuff has been laced through the music as well. So there was a cohort of men that were kind of standing up and saying, yes, we should. And then there was another cohort of men saying, don't let me in with that guy. I didn't do it. Mm. And that's very true. I mean, obviously that person, that one black man didn't do that other thing, but it was like, no one's going to agree on the same point. We aren't a monolith and we can't be expected to think as one. But there is a hope that as we kind of keep moving forward, we'll find more and more people starting to see themselves as protectors and as campaigners and as movers in this space and seeking to do great stuff and seeking to move the entire population forward. And I think that's happening. I expect within, like, we as a business, we support people to run, to, like I said, entrepreneurship, leadership, activism, we support people to learn how to do these things and do them well and do them sustainably over time. But most people do stuff and never register. Most people do it and kind of keep it on the down low, not down lows and hide it, but down lows, and they never really go outside of their social circle to talk about it and really do stuff and really work on like trying to register their social enterprise or register their charity and really make it a sustainable thing that could be, I don't know, the next, I don't know, Charity Water, which is a fantastic charity. But people just, black people just tend to not go that far. You kind of stick with your own people, your own little community. And I expect that in this time, there are lots and lots and lots of people starting to think, how can I help? people with mental health in the Black community? How can I help Black kids in their education? I'm a teacher, let me do that. Or how can I help ex-cons get back into employment? There's lots of things that people will be doing now. And our hope is that we can identify them all and help them kind of make it happen and make it stronger. But overwhelmingly, it will be Black women that go ahead and do it.
I mean, you say that, and I want to be in the forefront helping as well. And I think no matter how big or small it is, it's something that I feel is a responsibility for mine as well. Especially being a Black man, I want to be a leader as well, and not just in the workplace. It's not about showing up for a white corporation or, you know, someone that doesn't look like me and getting acceptance. It's about, no, what can I do from that experience to give back? And like that Jay-Z lyric was, you know, you give back to the community and stuff. And I do think about families as well, like how important it is to give them knowledge about how things are working in as well, not sort of giving them the fluffy talk of just, you know, smile and be your best and stuff, but also, you know, learn about economics, learn about how to, you know, manage your finances, learn about materialism and not to spend money on things to make yourself feel good, but build your self-esteem. Do you think that element of teaching to kids is a very important sort of learning skill that parents should give? And how do you sort of have those conversations? Or do you think it's hard to have those conversations at an early age and they need to sort of develop more in terms of life?
No, absolutely. I think you should start having those conversations as soon as the kid can understand you. I'm not a parent, so yeah. Everything with a grain of salt. But no, there are board games. I know a Black woman that created a board game to teach kids about finances. I mean, that's what Monopoly is supposed to be doing.
Yeah,
it's all important. It's all there. There's apps and things to help kids have a bank card that is their allowance, and they can, like, it's a kid's bank. It's a children's bank. There are so many interesting things going on, and I think we will see those organizations start coming up, those Saturday schools that teach you about, you know, will help you with maths and English, but also help you understand how to budget, how to plan, how to build a business. There are kids business camps that and I forget what it's called, but there's a guy who, I think it's a married couple actually, that have developed an app to teach kids how to run a business. So kids as young as like 12 are learning how to build a business online. Like, it's really very, very interesting. And it's all stuff that can be done with the Black community. And I think it's important to start as early as possible telling kids to be the best that they can be, but not detrimentally so. Not like, don't sacrifice yourself to be number one.
Yeah.
Like, do your best, give your best, but give your best to whatever it is your passion is about, not necessarily the very minuscule lens that parents tend to give you, especially when you're an immigrant.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking about immigrants and, you know, where we originally come from, you know, in terms of Africa as a continent, do you feel like the element of self-education, similar to what we're talking about here in the UK and other parts of the Western world, do you think that needs to be brought over there? What sort of problem areas can we help solve if we were to in that spectrum of things as well?
Sure. So when it comes to Africa, we focus on African tech specifically because there are so many things to fix. There's so many things to see and like try and fix and try and develop. And what we focus on is empowering tech entrepreneurs to fix those problems. So we support education tech entrepreneurs, we support fintech entrepreneurs that teach people how to budget properly. We support waste tech entrepreneurs and energy tech entrepreneurs and things like that. So we do quite a lot of wide ranging stuff within that space. But it's really about, not everyone can move back. Not everyone should move back. There's a lot going on. I moved back for about a year, just under a year, and I was told resoundingly to move back to London. I moved back to Nigeria, and I was like trying to do this work, and they were like, it would be so much more helpful if you were based in London and could form partnerships on our behalf. And that was when I realized, okay, not everyone needs to move back. And it felt like a little bit of a sadness, but I miss being in Nigeria every day. I think it's such a lovely place, and my entire family is there.
I was gonna say, what part, Lagos or
Lagos. We were in Abuja. We were in Abuja. And then we moved to Lagos a few years ago.
Yeah. Now carry on. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. So I was just saying, so we focus on technology because technology means that a tech company needs every part of the employment spectrum. So if you're going to build a tech company in Africa, you're going to need a building for your people, because remote working is starting to happen obviously because of COVID, but
yeah.
It's typically an in-person workspace, so you need a building. That means you need construction people, because everyone builds from scratch, which is still really just wow, but everyone builds from scratch. Then you need cleaners, you need security, you need gate men, you need caterers because of your cafe or whatever is in there. You then also need your data level, data entry people, you need your analysts, you need your kind of low tech people, you need your community people, you need your customer service people, you need your call center people, you need your developers, you need your senior managers. So it's, for us, tech companies felt like the most effective way to create jobs across the continent, because it means that you're able to hire a lot of different people, and because it's technology, you get to grow a lot quicker as well. We developed one of the first, if not the first, virtual accelerator program across Africa. And we've been doing that for about a year, 2 years now, maybe. We are really excited to kind of keep it moving, keep it growing. It's difficult because, I mean, there are so few things out. When we design something, we're not doing it to benefit a corporation, we're doing it to benefit the people. So financing it from corporations is difficult because they're like, what's my buy-in? Why do I need to pay for this? You're not going to give me any of the data. So it's been difficult to kind of manage it and keep it moving, but we've been able to support quite a lot of tech entrepreneurs so far, and we're hoping to be able to support 500 tech entrepreneurs or tech startups by 2023.
That's amazing.
So that's exciting. I mean, we need money. So if you want to donate, please do.
All right, we're gonna plug it in now. Where can people donate?
Sorry, what?
Where can people donate?
Oh, www.doitnownow.com/donate.
All right, I'm going to put that in the link somewhere. Definitely. Please. I want people to do that. Definitely. Listen to me. I think empowering Africa is probably the end goal from all this for me. Did I mention in the podcast? Fine, I'm going to mention it. I think with everything that's happened in our history as a whole, you know, Africa as a continent has so much richness that exists, but it's looked down upon. And it's crazy. It's like all the resources exist there. And you can say, you know, now it'll be labor and, you know, techs and startups and stuff, but it's rebuilding. You know, but historically speaking, everything was there, and for it to be stripped away and say, oh, look at it, it's poor, and then you have Red Nose Day and you're like, oh, look, there's someone starving today, and then they're like, oh, we raised like 50 million, and then the next year it's the same story over and over again. You know, like, why are you punching on this continent saying it's poor when you know you're stealing from it? And I don't like the perception of that. And I know there's corruption. I agree, you know, there's a lot of greed that exists there. But that's because there's little left and people are holding on to that. And the education behind those people understanding that they do have all the riches in the world, but it's that mindset that's kind of moved away, you know, at some point, and it's been replaced with something else. But with organizations like you coming in and re-educating and providing support and providing that empowerment to sort of do something with their lives and build communities, build an economy there, that just shows like the amount of growth that can accelerate if people have their minds right. So it's just nice to, you know, with our mindsets here, like give back and say this is what's possible. We can build and we can show the world what we're capable of. I think, you know, with the way the world's moving, I think there will be a complete paradigm shift with the way we're thinking about things now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the hope.
Yeah, that's the hope. Well, I think we've run over time, but I just wanted to ask if there's any like final statement you want to sort of give our listeners, what would it be?
thank you for this conversation. It's always great to be able to speak about these types of things, and thank you for creating the space to do so. I hope the listeners will kind of recognize their own power in whatever situation that they're in, and seek to dismantle the things that are stopping them. I'll speak directly to you, listener. Dismantle the things that are stopping you from being exactly who you want to be. It's important to figure out who you are. And what is that saying? Do it on purpose. Dolly Parton. Find out who you are and do it on purpose. If you decide that you want to start something, you want to build something, then we're here to help. It's all free, by the way, for the most part. Not everything is free anymore because COVID really kicked our butts. So we can't have everything for free anymore. But it's very cheap. And we just want to be here for you to make sure that you can build something that will make a difference in the world.
It's amazing. And like you said, where can they find you?
www.doitnownow.com.
Awesome. Like I said, I'll drop the links down. I want everyone to sort of go there and support, because it's such a great initiative with such a great message and such a great movement. And I want to see it grow, and I want to be a part of it as much as possible. So I'm going to donate as well. So feel free to go in and let me know what you think about this episode. I'd love to have you as a guest at some point in the future, because I think these conversations are very healthy and provide a lot of insight to people who don't even know what's going on in the world, and just sort of build a horizon. So I do appreciate you being on the call with me.
Thank you.
All right, then. So thanks for listening, and take care, guys. Hey, podcast listeners, thanks for listening, and thanks for my special guest, and thanks for clicking that play button. But I need you to do 4 things for me. I want you to like, comment, subscribe, and share this content. It will help tremendously with the growth of this podcast, and I'm producing more content than ever. So I want you guys to be the first to know, and I want others to know as well. So do those 4 things for me and help this podcast grow to a bigger platform. Thanks for listening.